When I was told that I was going to preach on 3 John in this series, One Hit Wonders, my immediate thought was, I don't know if I've ever read 3 John. Now, I know that I have twice, like both times I actually made it through my one-year Bible, which definitely took me more than 1 year. Thank you. But other than that, I guarantee you, I have never like chosen to sit down and study this book in depth. I don't remember ever hearing a sermon on 3 John. I definitely never had a class on it when I was here at Ozark. And guys, I will be really honest with you, it has been a while since I've even glanced in its direction, because when I did open up my Bible to study it, the pages were stuck together. I couldn't even get to the thing. So I realized pretty quickly, I am going to need to tackle this like any good interp student would. And I just need to start at step one, which is read the text and make some observations. So I did that, and I came up with two. Observation number one, this can hardly be called a letter. It is more like a postcard. I mean, take a look at the thing. Open up your Bibles, look at it. It is so short. In fact, fun fact, it is the shortest book in our Bibles. 2 John is shorter by verses. 3 John is shorter by word count. In the Greek, just over 200 words. So there you go. Second observation, whatever this thing is, it has the makings of a great three men walked into a bar joke. But, we will make it three men walked into a church. For obvious reasons. Let's not get too crazy. So I think it starts like three men walked into a church. A disciple, verse 1, a missionary, verse 12, and a jerk face, verse 9. And I don't really know how the rest of the joke goes yet, but I think the punchline is don't be a jerk face. So it's not a great joke, but that's literally all I got. So I knew at this point it's time to move on to step two in the interpretation process, right? Which is, of course, ask your friends for help. So I started by going to my office neighbor, John Carer, because he's a great guy, so helpful, and he's a great Bible scholar. So I popped in, I said, hey John, I don't want to take a lot of your time. I'm just gonna be really quick, I just have a question. He said, of course, what can I help you with? So helpful, right? And I said, hey, what's 3 John about? And he said, I have no idea. So very quick, not very helpful. So then I decided I'm gonna talk to Doug Welch because he teaches the Gospel of John, same author here, so surely he knows. So I went to Welch and I said, hey Doug, can you give me like a brief synopsis, like big idea of 3 John? And he said, 1 John? I said, no, 3 John. He said, 2 John? I said, no, 3. And then he stared at me, and I stared at him. And that was the end of our conversation. So then I thought, okay, Ackerman. He is teaching the new class this fall that's like a survey of the entire Bible, right? Newsflash, everybody. Apparently it's the entire Bible except 3 John, because he didn't know either. So this is not going swimmingly. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I must be going about this the wrong way. What am I missing? And I realized I just needed to be a good, biblical Corinthian housewife and ask my questions of my husband at home. And so I did. And I said, hey, Michael, help a sister out here. Just looking for a brief summary of 3 John. Just like point me in the right direction, man. And this is what he said, and I quote, 3 John reminds the people of God that if you don't commit yourself to something above you, you cannot love the people around you. And if you don't submit to something you don't get to control, something that doesn't bend even when you want it to, you can't treat people the way you know you should treat them because you'll only do it when you want to. And the flip side is, if you think you know the truth but don't open your arms to the actual people, the truth you think you know either isn't true or you don't really know it. Yeah. And then he said, it's something along those lines, but I haven't read it in a while. Something along those lines? Bro, your summary's longer than the letter, okay? Like, give me a break, man. He's so smart. He like reads all the time and he's good at so many things, but being brief? Not one of them. So at this point, I'm like, okay, Gotta move to step three in the interpretation process. We gotta get this ball rolling. So step three, of course, is to go and check out all the books Seth Wilson has to offer and get to work. And so I did, and good news, I now have a better understanding of what 3 John is about. And so here's what we're gonna do. We are going to start by just reading this brief letter together, and then we're gonna walk back through it, and we're just gonna ask ourselves this question. What does John's third letter to a church have to say to us as the church? So 3 John, verse 1. The elder, to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. It gave me great joy when some believers came and testified about your faithfulness to the truth, telling how you continue to walk in it. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Dear friend, you are faithful in what you're doing for the brothers and sisters, even though they are strangers to you. They have told the church about your love. Please send them on their way in a manner that honors God. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans. We ought, therefore, to show hospitality to such people so that we may work together for the truth. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will not welcome us. So when I come, I will call attention to what he's doing, spreading malicious nonsense about us. Not satisfied with that, he even refuses to welcome other believers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church. Dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone, and even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, and you know that our testimony is true. I have much to write to you, but I don't want to do so with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face. Peace to you. The friends here send their greetings. Greet the friends there by name. Now, I think a lot of times when we come to a biblical letter, when we start to study a biblical letter, maybe particularly the letters of Paul, we start to wade through the depth of theology and we try to decipher the doctrine, and all of that is super valuable, absolutely. But I think sometimes as we study, we kind of miss the relationship between the sender and the receiver that inspired this letter to be written in the first place. A lot of times we see these letters written to groups of people or to churches, and even when we see individuals named, we skip over the lives just to get to the lessons. But 3 John reminds us to read biblical letters differently. Because in this letter, there is no doctrine to decipher. There is no philosophy to ponder. It's just John writing to his dear friend Gaius. And Gaius gives us a great example of someone who is walking in obedience to the truth. In fact, I think we see 3 different examples of faithfulness in this letter. And 2 of them are right here in the introduction. I think the first one that stands out to me is generational obedience. Now, 3 different times in our NIV, we see John refer to Gaius as a dear friend. But for those of you reading in the ESV, you see something different, don't you? He uses the word beloved. Now, this word that we see, this term of endearment that we see 3 different times describing their relationship, it is from the word agape. And it is love, but it's more than a feeling. It's an attitude. This love is their bond, and their bond is firmly placed in truth. Now, this term of endearment may also sound familiar to those of you who have studied the Gospel of John, because 4 different times in John's Gospel, he refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, or as Jesus' beloved. But I want you to understand, this isn't John just having a big ego. This isn't John saying, I have a deeper, closer relationship with the teacher than any of the other disciples. No, if that were the case, if it were just ego, I think he would name himself so that he could claim that credit of being Christ's beloved. Now, John uses the word beloved in his gospel to remind all believers that when you follow Christ, you are given a new identity. He was no longer just John, son of Zebedee, brother of James, one half of the thunderous duo. No, I mean, he was now a beloved follower of Christ our King. And that transformation from his earthly identity to his heavenly one, that moved him from being focused on self to focused on others. It moved him to faithfulness, to obedience. So in similar fashion, John now commends Gaius for being faithful. He calls him a loved friend, beloved. And he applauds him for walking in truth, setting an example for others, being hospitable and kind to the Christian community, supporting traveling evangelists and missionaries, even when he didn't personally know them. John says, Gaius, I see you, and I'm proud of you. In fact, in verse 4, he says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. So John followed the footsteps of Jesus. Gaius followed the footsteps of John. And now these fellow believers who have testified to Gaius's faithfulness are going to carry on his example as well. I can tell you that generational obedience really is a gift to the church. Michael and I were both raised in the church. We were raised to love the church. We were raised to serve the church. And for that, we are thankful. But we were also both raised in single parent homes, which just inevitably meant that there are parts of discipleship that we're largely missing in our lives. And so we will forever be thankful for those who came and stood in that gap. For Michael, starting in high school all the way through college. For me, after I came here as a student to Ozark. We can name person after person who invited us into their homes, who taught us, counseled us, mentored us, disciplined us, loved us, who invited us to follow them as they followed Christ. That had an impact on me. But I'm going to be honest with you, if you would have asked me 20 years ago, if I thought that I could have that same kind of impact, I would have told you no way. I didn't know how to be a wife. I didn't know how to be a mother. I didn't know how to be a mentor or a pastor or a teacher. I barely knew how to be a friend. But what's interesting is as I've walked in obedience through these years, I know things have changed, but I still didn't really understand the impact of generational obedience until very recently. Many of you guys know Brandon and Alexia Musselman. They're seniors here who have already left and they're working with a church plant up in the New England area. And Brandon and Alexia, like many of our students, have become very, very dear to us. They've spent a lot of time in our home and we have walked with them through some delicate seasons in a very short amount of time. And last fall, I was in my classroom and I was having a conversation with one of my students who was struggling with an assignment that I had given them. Kind of, in no uncertain terms, they were letting me know that they thought this assignment was a waste of their time. And maybe also my class was a waste of their time. It happens. But what I didn't know was that Brandon and Alexia were standing outside of my classroom door. They were waiting on me to go to lunch. And Alexia told me later, she actually had to hold Brandon back from coming into the room. She said, look, she doesn't need your help. She's got this. And he looked at her and he said, I know she's got this. I know what she's made of. That's my spiritual mother in there. And I just want to make sure that kid knows who he's talking to. That still blows my mind. And I don't tell you that story to pat myself on the back at all. When I hear things like that, I am deeply humbled. And I am immediately drawn to prayer. I utter prayers of thanksgiving. Yes, prayers of thanksgiving for the faithfulness of students like Brandon and Alexia. Prayers of thanksgiving for the faithfulness of students like Drake Holderman and Olivia Lowry, like Nathan Storms, Connor LeBlanc, Mackenzie Mullen, and so many others. But I also, in that same breath, utter prayers of thanksgiving for people like Jason and Janice French, for Jim and Andrea Johnson, for Mark and Carla Scott, for Mark and Barbara Moore, for Greg and Deb Hafer, and so many others. Because if it were not for their obedience to the truth, if it were not for them being disciples of Jesus, I would not be here, standing in the middle, marveling at you, beloved disciples. Generational obedience matters. It's a gift to the church, and I'm thankful for that reminder right here in 3 John. I think another example of obedience that Gaius gives us, we see again right here in the introduction, but this one's a little bit cloaked. When you dig a little deeper, I think you see it. I'm going to call this one situational obedience. Now, when I use the word situational, I don't mean that sometimes you're obedient and sometimes you're not. That's not what I mean. I mean being obedient in situations where it's really tough to stay the course. Look back at verse 2. In a lot of biblical letters, the sender will offer some kind of prayer for the recipient. That's not uncommon. But what's interesting is John's prayer here for Gaius. He says, "Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well." Or again in the ESV, "Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul." Now, the scholars, the historians that I consulted, they all agree that prayers for well wishes and good health, that was not uncommon in the ancient world, just like it's not uncommon in our world today. But what's different is John's tag of, "as it is with your soul." Now, it could be that John is just once again affirming Gaius's faithfulness. Because let's be honest, there's a lot of Christians today that would be in a world of hurt if all of the sudden their physical health instantly matched their spiritual health. Like, we're talking problems, right? But not so with Gaius. No, John could be saying here, if your body is anywhere close to the supreme health of your soul, good for you, man. Good for you. But there is another possibility. It's possible that Gaius's physical health is not in great shape. And that what John is praying is, your spiritual health is in fabulous condition, and I pray that your physical health would improve to match it. And if that's the case, this may be part of the testimony that these fellow believers have brought to John. Gaius is an inspiration to them in his unwavering obedience in the face of physical trials. And I can't help but wonder, again, if John might be reflecting on his time walking with Jesus, if he might be thinking about the time they met the blind man that we read about in John chapter 9. See, Jesus and his disciples, they meet this blind man outside of the temple, and the disciples' immediate question is, "Rabbi, who sinned? This guy or his parents that he was born blind?" But Jesus responds, "It wasn't this man who sinned or his parents. This happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Aaron spoke to us last week about the hope that we cling to in moments of desperation. And the incredible thing about that hope is that it doesn't just change our disposition, but it stands as a testimony that God is still to be praised. Now, I imagine that every single one of us in this room knows someone who has had to live faithfully in the fire. Maybe someone in your family or in your sphere has faced cancer or another debilitating disease. Maybe someone you know has had to navigate divorce or the loss of a child. Maybe for others, the fire came in frustrating finances or overcoming addictions or healing from abuse. And maybe it's not someone you know. Maybe it's you. Well, whatever the situation is, you know how difficult it can be to be faithful in trying times. But what I hope is that you also know how rewarding it can be. I have a friend who just lost her dad a week ago. And 4 days before he passed away, she was sharing with me that he was a prayer warrior. He was a man who prayed all the time about everything in life. And she was showing me letters that he had written her that were full of prayer. She was telling me stories of prayers that he had prayed over her children that were significant. She said his prayer life was an inspiration to her when he was well. But it was actually after he took this fall and ended up in the hospital that his prayer life made the biggest impact. So he had been in the hospital for over 30 days. And he was mostly nonverbal. He would make some noises, some grunts here or there, but most of it, they couldn't decipher, except for one phrase. There was one thing that he kept saying over and over again, and they could hear it clearly. He kept saying, "And I pray, and I pray, and I pray." And sometimes they could understand a name at the end of that phrase, and sometimes they couldn't. But you know, Jesus said, "Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks." Or as my grandfather used to say, "Whatever's in the well is gonna come out in the water." And I hope and I pray that when I find myself in distress or with disease or at death's door, that I don't forget to give praise, to give honor where honor is due. Now, the third example that we see of walking in obedience in this letter, I think it's the most significant example in the entire letter, and I think that because it takes up the entire rest of the letter. Pretty good sign. We're gonna call this one missional obedience. Now, John has stressed in all of his writings that truth is paramount for the Christian. In fact, the noun form of truth, aletheia, occurs 25 times in the Gospel of John, 9 times in 1 John, 5 times in 2 John, and 6 times in 3 John. 6 times in a letter with only 14 verses. Truth is a big deal. On top of that, Jesus says in John's gospel at least 7 times that his words are true. In John chapter 5, Jesus says John the Baptist bore witness to the truth, which is of course in reference to him. And in John chapter 14, Jesus says one of the most explicit statements in the gospel, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Jesus is the truth. Truth is a very big deal. In fact, I hope that you will all come back next week. I hope that you all will tune in next week because we're gonna hear another sermon on 2 John, and it's gonna be a good reminder of the imperative nature of truth in our lives. But here's the deal. Jesus, who is truth, did not just call us to obedience in truth alone. Now, the first 2 times that we see this word in the Gospel of John are in the prologue in verses 14 and 17. And this is what it says. "The word became flesh and he made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth." For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. See, as Christ has extended grace and truth to us, we are now called to extend love and truth to those around us. Or if I could put it in other words, walking in obedience to the truth mandates love for one another. And this is the most important and beautiful balancing act you will ever perform. And this is the exact balancing act that we see in 3 John. See, Gaius is faithful to the truth in verses 3 and 4, and he's faithful in love in verses 5 through 8. John says that those who were traveling and seeking support were working on behalf of the name. And yes, Jesus is never explicitly mentioned in 3 John, but we know from Acts chapter 5 and Romans 1, I'm good. In Romans 1, that the name is used in reference to Jesus all the time. Also, believing in the name of Jesus is a common refrain in the Gospel of John. Now, these are missionaries who are going out on behalf of the name. And they're not gonna garner support from those that they're evangelizing. This is our job. This is the job of fellow believers. This is the job of Gaius. This is what John is saying. Now, this kind of hospitality is not just a mundane responsibility, guys. This is joining together in laboring for Christ. This is working together in truth. This is love in action. Now, I can't help but wonder at this point if John is now reflecting on his first letter. Because in 1 John chapter 3, he says, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another." If we see brothers and sisters in need, and we have material possessions, and we have no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. Marianne Thompson puts it this way in her commentary: "Gaius demonstrated wholehearted allegiance to God's truth as manifested in concrete actions to specific individuals." Gaius understood that walking in obedience to the truth mandates love for one another. Here's the problem. Diotrephes did not. Look back at verse 9. It would appear that John apparently wrote another letter before this one, which coincidentally would make this John 4, 4th John, but you know, who's counting at this point? But he's asked Diotrephes in this letter to act in love as obedience to the truth, but John is met with a resounding no. Now, we don't know what's going on between these guys. This could be that they're having a disagreement over doctrine. This could be a blow up over personality differences. Maybe they have like different political allegiances, although I cannot imagine a church splitting over politics. That'd be crazy. Or maybe this is just an issue of pride, plain and simple. We don't know. But whatever the problem is, Diotrephes is rejecting any kind of resolution. In fact, he's not just rejecting John, he's rejecting anyone associated with John. He has closed his doors to missionaries. He won't take in Demetrius, who is the apparent letter carrier here. Diotrephes has decided that it will be his way or the highway. He is going to stay over here, firmly planted in truth, and he is rejecting the notion that love is a necessity to obedience. But John begs to differ. Again, in 1 John, this time chapter 2, he says, anyone who claims to be in the light but hates a brother or sister is still in the darkness. Anyone who loves their brother or sister lives in the light, and there's nothing in them to make them stumble. But anyone who hates a brother or sister is in the darkness, and they're walking around in darkness. They do not know where they're going, because the darkness has blinded them. Well, unfortunately, I have known a Diotrephes in my day. When I was in the sixth grade, we moved to a small Midwest town. You know the type that has five churches for 500 people. And we immediately started attending the independent, non-denominational Christian church in town. That made sense. But the problem was that church didn't have any youth programming. There was no youth group. There was nothing for kids over elementary age. And so when we heard that the Methodist minister in town was starting an after-school Bible club, we started attending, and my mom started volunteering. And pretty soon we started also attending youth group on Wednesday nights and Sunday nights. And then my mom was invited by the other Methodist ladies to be a part of different things they were doing. Then she was asked by all of the churches in the community to put together a community choir and lead a big Easter cantata. And all of this was good and warm and unifying for the churches on this side of town. But for the independent non-denominational church on this side of town, a storm was brewing. See, unbeknownst to my mom, that minister decided he needed to pay my grandparents a visit. And he said to my grandfather that he needed to perform an intervention because his daughter had lost her way. She was dabbling in other faiths, and this minister said, I am afraid for her salvation and for the salvation of her children. Now, my grandpa's not one to ruffle feathers and certainly doesn't want to stir a pot when it comes to the church, but he was a little annoyed at the ice in this man's veins. And so he simply said, yeah, I think she's all right. But then he said, hey, if you think you need to have a conversation with her, go ahead. She's a grown woman and she can answer for her actions. But nothing was said to my mom yet. It wasn't until she volunteered to oversee vacation Bible school at the Christian church that one of the elders came to her and said, you can have this responsibility. What a blessing. You can have this as long as you don't invite any of your friends from other faiths to volunteer. My mom responded, I don't actually know anybody from other faiths. And he said, you know what I mean. Nobody from the other churches. Well, after vacation Bible school, we didn't go back. We actually made the Methodist church in town our home for a while. And while we were there, actually our youth group at the Methodist church joined forces with the youth group at the Baptist church, and we all met together for a season. That was fun. And then these two churches, along with the Pentecostal church and the Brethren in church, we had some rockin' Easter cantatas. It was good. Because see, here's what John says in 1 John chapter 4. He says, dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. And John Stott puts it like this. He says, Christian unity is grounded in the truth alone, but that truth generates agape. And this is both an internal force and an external reality. God's truth and love will never be outdated or eclipsed. I don't know what the past experience of this minister was with people from other traditions. I don't know why he was angry. I don't know why he was afraid, but I do know this. John, this elder, is giving this charge to Diotrephes, to Gaius, and to us. Don't let negative experiences in the church, don't let petty disagreements, don't let non-essentials, don't let traditions, don't even let different interpretations of the same text be an excuse for you to block fellow believers from your life. Be hospitable to everyone. Love everyone. Be discerning about the truth that they are telling you. Yes, absolutely. But do not withhold your love. Because if you walk in truth without love, You are walking on shaky ground, and you will be a jerk face. You know, it turns out that Michael's synopsis of 3 John was correct. If you don't commit yourself to something above you, you cannot love the people around you. And if you don't submit to something you don't get to control, something that doesn't bend even when you want it to, you can't treat people the way you know you should treat them because you'll only do it when you want to. And the flip side is, if you think you know the truth, but you don't open your arms to actual people, the truth you think you know either isn't true or you don't really know it. Or if I could help him out a little bit, walking in obedience to the truth mandates love for one another. You know, Randy Alcorn wrote a little book and he called it the Grace and Truth Paradox, Responding in Christlikeness. And this whole book is based on John 1:14. And he says, the test is to hold both of these in perfect unison, without excuse, because grace without truth deceives people, and truth without grace crushes people. But if held in unison, if held in tension, if held in tandem, then truth and grace changes everything.